And in this chapter, we're talking about stars, distant suns. We looked at the sun in our previous chapter, and now we're looking at other stars. And what we'll see is they all have a lot in common. This was not known 100 years ago. And we'll start by looking at something we've covered before back in chapter 2, and that is, how do we estimate the temperature of distant stars? How do we know how hot a star is? Well, it's very simple. You look at Wien's law, that temperature and color are correlated. We saw back in chapter 2 that all objects above absolute zero emit electromagnetic radiation, because the molecules, the atoms, are oscillating, and that oscillation produces the temperature, the heat, and any charged particle in motion is going to produce electric fields, which produce magnetic fields, which produce electric fields, and you have this self-propagating series of waves that comprise light, as James Clerk Maxwell showed us in the middle of the 19th century. And as the temperature of the object increases, the atoms become more energetic. And what does that mean? The frequency increases of the radiation, and the wavelength decreases. It becomes bluer as opposed to redder. Whereas as the temperature drops, the atoms are more sluggish, the radiation frequency decreases, and the wavelengths become longer. And so cooler objects become redder objects. Most objects on Earth, such as yourself, myself, emit infrared radiation, and we're not visible, which is not visible. As the temperature begins to increase, we begin initially to see the longest wavelengths of visible radiation, which is red. And that's why the first thing that you see beginning to glow is kind of a dull red piece of iron that's being heated, or a campfire, or your mom's stove. Radiation curves have been obtained of stars and other objects that are emitting temperature. And it's been known for 100 years or so that the temperature of an object will determine its color based on its radiation curve. The radiation curve shows where most of the radiation is being emitted, at what wavelengths, and it's a very precise correlation between an object's color and temperature. And here we see an example of what we're talking about. And it's amazing when you think about this. The visible light spectrum right here, you remember we said it's about the thickness of 1/100th the thickness of a piece of paper, and a spectrum of radiation that's 20 million miles long. And yet that is the very region where stars peak, and we can see colors. Most of them peak in this range here. So if it peaks at 7,000 Kelvin, it's going to be in the blue to purple. If it peaks at about 4,000, peaks here, the red and orange. If it peaks an object, whether it's a star or a piece of molten metal or whatever, if it peaks at 1,000, we're only going to see just a very dull red, because just a little bit of the curve is down here in the visible region. Whereas something at 300 degrees Kelvin, such as your body heat right where you sit, it's not going to be any portion of that visible in under visible light. So if we turn the lights out, we can't see each other in this room, unless you're wearing infrared goggles, because you clearly can see infrared at 300 degrees Kelvin. And so that's how we tell the temperature of a star. Where does that radiation curve peak will determine its approximate temperature. And the same is true for metals or anything on the surface of the Earth. Okay, let's talk about the color of stars for a minute. We see different colors, magnificent colors, and there's a spectral classification system that has been developed over the last 150 years or so, which classifies stars based on their color. But it's these classifications here, O, B, A, F, G, K, M, and then LT. These are red dwarf stars, basically. O, B, A, fine guy or girl, kiss me. That's the most famous mnemonic device to memorize that. There are many, many others. In fact, there have been contests to see what the most original way to memorize that classification system might be. But the thing to point out here is this classification system is based on the star's color, starting out at the top with the O stars. Those are violet stars, going down the list to blue, B. The A-class stars are bluish. The F-class stars are blue to white. The G, which is our sun, white to yellow. And then skipping on down, you go orange to red, red, and infrared. So the stars can be classified based on color, which is also associated with the star's temperature, as we've seen. So the O stars tend to be giants. They're violet to blue. They're super hot, and they burn up their fuel quickly, and they have very short lifespans. And you can skip on down to the cooler stars down there, such as the K, the M, the L, T. The temperatures are much lower. Those are long-burning stars. Astronomers estimate some of those can have a lifespan in the hundreds of billions of years because they emit hardly any energy. Here's our sun. It's a G-class star, 5 to 6,000 degrees Kelvin. Looks something like this. It's actually white. Many people think the sun is yellow. That has to do more with the atmospheric conditions or where it is on the horizon, as a, you know, straight above versus on the horizon where more of the light is refracted. But if you look at the sun at noon, you know, pretty much straight overhead, crossing the meridian, you're going to see it essentially white in color. Talk about the spectral classifications, the spectral lines. We've talked about these back in Chapter 2, those lines that are the fingerprints of the elements. You remember, we saw that every element is associated with a specific signature of absorption lines, and every molecule similarly. We also see that every star has its own unique spectrum. No two stars have the same spectrum. It's just like fingerprints. So when we put the spectra of our sun on the Voyager spacecraft, I mean, that you talk about a telltale way to give away your location. I mean, that's going to be so easy for the Romulans to find us. Now, we know that most stars, and we'll see this in the next chapter, are very similar in composition to our sun, 75% hydrogen and 23% helium, and all the other elements, everything else. But the spectral lines are very different due to the temperature of the star. And I don't want to go into great detail on this, other than to say that in the hottest stars, even though they're 75% hydrogen, you see very few absorption lines corresponding to hydrogen. And why is that? Because in the hottest stars, the stars ionize the hydrogen atoms, and they strip the electrons from the protons, and so you don't have the electrons going up and down in the orbits about the nucleus based on absorbing or emitting photons of a particular frequency and wavelength. Similarly, in the coolest stars, we see very little hydrogen lines because they just don't have the energy to boost the ground state electron to those higher levels. So it turns out that hydrogen lines are not visible in the hottest or coolest stars, even though hydrogen comprises 75% of the mass of those stars. The strongest hydrogen lines are associated with stars with a temperature of about 10,000 degrees Kelvin. So here we see an example of, on the left-hand side here, all the different classifications of stars. So you look at the O class at the top, which are the largest, hottest, most energetic. All the hydrogen basically has been ionized there. We don't see any strong hydrogen lines. And similarly, down here in the M and K stars, these are your red dwarf stars. You don't see nearly the definition of those hydrogen lines that you see up here, for example, in the B and the A class stars. Here's the sun spectrum, chopped up. You know, this is one continuous spectrum going left to right, and it's just put in layers here just for so we can see it more clearly for display purposes. Now, as we saw back in Chapter 2, it's amazing. We know from those stellar spectra that the elements are the same everywhere in the universe. Galaxies 10 and 12 billion light years away. We can put the light from those galaxies through a simple spectroscope and tell exactly what the components of that galaxy are. And we see everything virtually on the periodic table of elements, but we see nothing new. We also see molecules, because every molecule has its own signature absorption lines. And believe me, that is quite a challenge in spectroscopy, to look at these just unbelievable number of lines and extract from them the composition of that galaxy based on elements and compounds. But it can be done. A lot of it's done by software today. And this is the breakdown. The universe is about 92% hydrogen. So of every 1 million hydrogen atoms, there's 80,000 helium atoms, there's 690 oxygen, 420 carbon, and then from there it drops off significantly. But it's amazing to me that we can very accurately estimate the composition of the universe. Not just individual stars nearby, but galaxies billions of light years away, and of the entire universe itself. This is what it's made of. As I say, if a UFO lands here by the clock tower tonight and loses a hubcap, I mean, that's not going to be some exotic element that we've never heard of before. It's not going to be. It's going to be something on this list right here, the periodic table that you memorized in chemistry. That's an amazing thought. Elements are the same everywhere in the universe. There's no exotic new elements that have been detected. There were initially. Helium had never been detected before the use of spectroscopy 150 years ago. And it was named Helios because it was found by observing absorption lines in the sun's spectrum that didn't correspond to any known element. And so helium was discovered. And it was called helium for Helios, the Greek term for sun. Krypton and a few other gases especially were discovered solely by spectroscopic analysis of the sun. Now, let me mention this. Each stellar class, OBA, FG, KM, LT, every class has 10 subcategories, ranging from 0 to 9, with 0 being the hottest, 9 the coolest. Our sun is a G2, meaning it's the third hottest subcategory of the G class of stars. Those L and T classes are also based on temperature. These are red dwarfs and brown dwarfs, very limited nuclear reactions, really no full proton fusion taking place. Why? Because they're too small. There's not enough pressure. Here's an artist's depiction of a brown dwarf with three stellar companions off here in the distance. But here is kind of a non-starter. You know, there's limited proton-proton fusion going on here, but not enough to ignite a star. But there's still still illumination taking place, but it's very dark. And that's why, you know, astronomers believe the vast majority of stars in the universe are the L and the T class stars, the brown dwarfs, as well as the K and the M, the red dwarf stars. But they're small and they're very low luminosity, and so we can't detect them. The nearest known star to our solar system, Proxima Centauri, is 4.2 light years away. Astronomers now believe there are probably thousands, certainly hundreds, of stars closer than that, but we can't see them because they're these low luminous red and brown dwarfs that are just semi. What should I say? They're not fully engaged in fusion reaction. It's very limited fusion reactions because there's not enough pressure to provide the heat, the 10 to 15 million degrees Kelvin, that's necessary to sustain fusion reactions. So you have just a sputtering kind of a failed star. It just doesn't have enough mass. You can see why those things are hard to spot. Now, from those stellar spectra, it's interesting, and this has only been known for 100 years, but look at what we can know by using a simple spectroscope and observing a star or galaxy. We know the approximate size of that object. We know its approximate composition because of those absorption lines. We know the abundance of the elements and molecules because of the strength of the lines. We know the temperature of the object. We know its radial velocity. Is it moving toward us or away from us, and at what fraction of the speed of light? We know whether it's rotating or not by looking for broadening in those absorption lines. Okay, before we take our break, I want to just introduce this topic of celestial distances. How in the world do we compute how far away things are in the universe? This is a great challenge for astronomy. You look up at the sky at night, as people did for thousands of years, and you look at all these objects, these stars, planets, etc., galaxies. How in the world can we begin to fathom how far away these things are? And that's the interesting topic here in this portion of the chapter. What is the farthest object we can see in the universe, and how do we know it's the most distant? Can we measure distances on an astronomical scale? And if so, how do we do so? What are the yardsticks that astronomers use? The speed of light equals about 300,000 kilometers per second. An astronomical unit, we've seen, is a convenient yardstick in the solar system. It's the average distance between the sun and the Earth, which we've rounded up to 100 million miles. It's closer to 92 to 94 million. Light year, another convenient yardstick, but again, it's rooted in it's anthropomorphic, you might say. It only has relevance on Earth, because we're looking at how far does light travel in one Earth year. Not a Jovian year, not a year on Pluto, but or not a year on some other planet in some other solar system. How long does it take light to travel in one Earth year? So light left a star 100 light years away 100 years ago. The sun is 8.5 light minutes away. The moon is 1.5 light seconds. Pluto is 5 light hours. You know, we looked briefly back in chapter 7, I think it was, at the Cassini-Huygens mission to Saturn. Cassini is still orbiting Saturn today, and it sent the Huygens probe soft landing on the surface of Titan, the largest of Saturn's satellites, 300 degrees below zero. And it took some phenomenal pictures on the surface. It's scientists believe that actually that probe, as it was descending, it actually hit a boulder and probably toppled over. And the point is, that's about 1.7 light hours away out there at Titan. And so even if you could see down there, oh, man, look at that boulder. We got to send a message. You know, it's going to be 1.7 hours before that message reaches that spaceship. It's not enough time. So you have to anticipate these things in advance and program the software to handle it. That could easily be done, couldn't it? Survey the surface, and if you see some large object that could maybe destabilize the landing, hit one of the engines for a few seconds. Parsecs, 3.26 light years. It's the distance associated with the parallax of one arc second along a one astronomical unit baseline. You know, don't worry about that definition. It's probably more commonly used by astronomers than light years. Although, again, it makes no sense anywhere in the universe other than from the perspective of Earth. Kiloparsec is 1,000 parsecs. Megaparsec is 1,000,000 parsecs. So if you look at a galaxy, for example, that's 60 million light years away, you could say that that is, 20 MPCs, 20 megaparsecs, for example. That is very common terminology that you'll see. In this movie, there's a famous line where that character right there was asked if his spaceship was fast, and he says this: "She made the Kessel run in less than 12 parsecs." Well, that's using parsecs as a unit of time, when in fact parsec is a unit of distance. That's one of the flaws in that movie. Okay, measuring those distances in the universe, a major challenge. We've had, I'd say, limited success. I think it's been quite striking the success astronomers have had in recent years, in the last century, certainly, to measure distances. Let's continue with this topic. Well, what about measuring distances in the solar system? How do we measure how far the moon is from us, or the sun, or the planets? Well, the most accurate way we do that today is with radar, and also shooting radio beams off, and laser beams, actually, off these objects. When the Voyager spacecraft flew by the Jovian planets, it sent messages back to Earth, and from those messages, it could be calculated the approximate distance of the planets. And it turns out that up to about 60 light years, we can use triangulation using Earth-based telescopes and the Earth's orbit. And we'll look at an example of this here in just a minute. 0 to 300 light years, we can still use triangulation or parallax measurements using the Hipparchus satellite data. And again, I'll explain that in more detail. But once we get beyond 300 light years, we're not using geometric triangulation because we just don't have the equipment that's sophisticated enough to measure these angles. There are spacecraft that are being planned that would extend these parallax measurements out to maybe even a million light years. But we have to use other objects, such as variable stars, most notably the Cepheid variables, and we'll take a look at that amazing story here later this evening, which these are stars that give us the ability to measure objects in space out to about 60 million light years. And then different types of supernovae explosion can be used as standard candles, and we can use them to come up with rough approximations of distances. Now, let's take a look at the concept of triangulation. It's just basic geometry, also referred to as parallax, which comes from a Greek word that simply means change. And we did this before. You know, if you put your thumb 3 inches from your nose and then alternate opening your left and then your right eye, and just look at how much your thumb moves. Okay, just keep opening and closing one eye and then the other with your thumb maybe 3 inches in front of your nose, and then move it closer to your nose, and then move it out to arm's length. And now look at my thumb and do it. Do you see any motion at all? The answer is no. And that's only 20 feet away. What if it's 20 trillion miles away, like a nearby star would be? That's the difficulty of measuring distances in space. And that's why that was one of the most profound and enduring justifications for the geocentric theory of the universe, that the Earth is the center and everything else is rotating around us. How else could you explain the fact that we couldn't detect parallax in any object? Well, the answer was those objects are much farther away than we ever even dreamed possible, and we don't have the sophistication in instrumentation to measure those angles. That change in the position of the object is what's called parallax, that sideways change in motion. Okay, and here's how surveyors measure objects on the surface of the Earth. And as it turns out, AC, and that's this line from this point to the target, and BC, this line from here to here, which essentially are going to be the same distance, can be computed if you know the baseline width from A to B, if you know this width right here, and you know these two angles. So if you know these three things, the baseline and these two angles right here from these points to this distant point, you can measure through geometry the distance to point C. Parallax is more noticeable, as we've seen, the closer the object or the wider the baseline. Now, the basic idea, the parallax is greater for closer objects. It's very small for distant objects. Here are just 20 or 30 feet from you. You can't detect any. What if we're talking about miles or billions of miles or trillions of miles in the case of stars? Stars are very far away, and as a result, no parallax was visible from the Earth's surface until, I think, 1838, when the star 61 Cygni was the first star whose parallax was actually measured. Yes, here's an indicator of where this star is right here. I mean, it's of no consequence. It's not visible. Well, it would be visible this time of year. It only is of historic relevance that that is the first star with a parallax measurement. Again, the person, Friedrich Bessel, that was measuring it didn't have any idea which of these stars was the closest one and would have the there would be the easiest job of measuring a parallax. Here's the Hipparchus space satellite, which was up for about 5 years, and it obtained just a mountain of data measuring the parallax angles to several different stars. 50 parallax measurements were done within 1% accuracy prior to Hipparchus, all for stars within 10 light years. Hipparchus compiled a high definition within 1% accuracy catalog of 120,000 stars to 1/10,000th of an arc second accuracy, which would be the equivalent of a golf ball in New York City viewed from London, including 8 Cepheid variable stars. And then it did lower definition within 10% accuracy, 90% accurate, in other words, on another 1,000,000 stars. So this was incredible data for determining distances to many, many stars in our galaxy. And it provided accurate measurements out to about 300 light years. And again, that's in our backyard because our galaxy, the Milky Way galaxy itself, is 120,000 light years, so in diameter. So when you're looking at stars 300 light years away, these are neighborhood stars, believe me. NASA plans further satellites dedicated to parallax measurements that might take us out to 1,000,000 light years. And that would be, we'd be able to measure the distance of any star in our galaxy, for example. Now here's the European Space Agency's Gaia satellite. It's due to be launched in the year 2012, and it will be able to measure stellar distances to within 10% accuracy, as far with a 10% error bar, as far as the galactic center, about 25,000 light years away. So I just want you to see that this whole field of measuring the distances to stars with high accuracy is just really beginning to get into gear. It began with the Hipparchus satellite, you know, that measured distances of many, many hundreds of thousands of stars out to 300 light years, and now we're going to move that back to tens of thousands or more light years away. The Gaia satellite is going to be in a Lagrangian point. You remember we talked about those before? Those are those, what should I say, stable points in, there are five of them in the Earth-Sun system, that if you put an object at any one of those Lagrangian points, the orbit will not disintegrate or deteriorate, and it's a perpetual, a permanent orbit. Remember we said that there are those that believe that if an intelligent civilization ever came our way, they would have left artifacts of themselves in the Lagrangian points. And NASA has actually done some investigations of the Lagrangian points to see if anything can be detected. And with the sophistication of the instruments that have been devoted to that study, they could have seen something the size of a school bus at any of the five Lagrangian points defining the Earth-Sun system, and nothing was detected. It could be a breadbox size. Okay, let's talk about one of the most powerful analytical tools ever devised in astronomy, and that's the Hertzsprung-Russell diagram. This tool is kind of like a Mozart piano concerto or a Wagnerian opera. The more you study it, the more depth of insight that you obtain. You're constantly peeling away more layers of understanding and insight. And that's the way it is with this incredible tool that Ejnar Hertzsprung, a Danish astronomer, and Henry Norris Russell, a very prominent early 20th century American astronomer, created. It was a joint effort. Russell, it turns out, was the son of a Presbyterian minister, and he is reputed to have memorized the entire New Testament. Now, we can look at the basic concept behind the Hertzsprung-Russell diagram as follows. It's basically plotting the luminosity of stars with their temperature. But unfortunately, and I've never fully understood why they did this, the temperature axis they reversed, so it looks like this. So you're starting out zero here and then getting hotter and hotter as you move across to the left on that axis. Okay, that's a very important point to grasp. But that's essentially the Hertzsprung-Russell diagram, looking at how luminous stars are according to a particular scale, and how hot they are, and then you just plot them they plotted, I think, something like 20,000 stars, and they came up with this incredible result that transformed our understanding of the life cycle of stars. And here's their work of some of their brightest stars that they detected. Now, again, we look at luminosity on this axis, and then we look at surface temperature on this axis. Now, it turns out we can also look at the spectral classification, the OBAFGKMLT, because those are associated with both mass and temperature. And so, again, the more you start to look at this, the more insights you begin to extract, the more interrelationships, the more conclusions that can be derived from this. So, very important on this axis down here, we can look at the spectral classifications we've just looked at, which are a function of surface temperature, which are a function of mass, okay? And on this axis is the luminosity of the star. Now, what they discovered was that 90% of all stars, in fact, a little bit more than that, are on what they call the main sequence, which is this arrow right here. And you can see that clearly from this diagram. The vast majority of the stars are in that arrow. And there's a few up here that we'll talk about in a minute, and there's a few down here, and there's actually a few down here. But the vast majority of stars, it turns out, 90% plus, are on this main sequence. In the main sequence, Hertzsprung and Russell determined that these are stars that are characterized by kind of a stable burning phase. Proton-proton fusion reactions are taking place. That's your standard nuclear fusion reactions that we'll talk about in the next chapter. A star spends 90% of its life on the main sequence. So our sun is right here somewhere. G-class star on the main sequence. Stable burning phase. Then up here on the right-hand side, you know, again, you see a lot of stars clustered up here, not nearly as many as here. These supergiants up here are cool. So they're down. If you go to come down here, you can see the temperature. It's much lower, 3,000 degrees versus 25,000 degrees. So these are cooler, but they're high in luminosity because of their great size. So these would be red giants and supergiants, stars that have exploded out to and bloated out to an incredible size, just like sometimes you feel like when you've been to a certain food buffet restaurant. You feel bloated. And that's how these stars are. They're toward the end of their burning cycle. They've exhausted much of their nuclear fuel, and they begin to swell and to bloat out. And as they do, they become highly luminous because their surface area increases, but they become very cool. They cool down, and they become red in color, and so they're called the red supergiants, red giants. These are only about 1%, by the way, of all stars. It looks like it's a disproportionate number here on this diagram. This would appear to be, 20 or 30% of all stars, but as it turns out, it's closer to 1%. Now, down here in the lower left-hand side, you have the white dwarf stars. Now, what are we looking at here? We're looking at stars that are very hot because they're at this end of the spectrum, and they're very low in luminosity. Now, what would be a low luminosity but very hot star? And that's a white dwarf. These comprise about 10% of all stars. So actually, there are 10 times more of these than there are of these. White dwarfs, again, are the remnants of a star, the kind of the old age of most stars. Our sun eventually will turn into a white dwarf star. They begin to shrink, and they become extremely luminous, extremely hot, but they're very small. A lot of these stars are no bigger than the size of the Earth. So they've gone from 1 million to 2 million times the size of the Earth down to the size of the Earth. No matter how luminous you are, your overall luminosity is going to be very low, and that's the way it is with these white dwarf stars. And then way up here in the top left-hand corner, you have a few stars. These are high luminosity and high temperature. They are typically your O-class purple and violet and bluish supergiant star. Because they're so massive and because they're so luminous, there's a tremendous energy output here, and these stars burn up their fuel very, very quickly. These are probably the youngest stars. These are the stars that have the shortest lifespan. And as a result, they don't stay on the main sequence very long. And as we'll see, in star clusters, you can actually estimate the age of a star cluster by using the main sequence line as a wick. And the shorter that wick, the older the star cluster, because the younger stars have all burned up and have left the main sequence. Now, down here in the bottom right-hand corner, you have these red and brown dwarfs. They're very cool, and they're very low luminosity. Some of them are even protostellar. They're not actually massive enough to form a star. And it's, you know, the Hertzsprung-Russell diagram is depicted in various ways. Here are what the human eye perceives to be the different spectral classifications. The O is the first class. It's the hottest, the largest, the most luminous. And as we see here, they're very rare. Probably only about one out of every 32,000 stars would be an O-class star, so don't expect to find a lot of them. They're fast burners, leave the main sequence quickly. One example is Delta Orionis. The three-star belt of Orion, this is the third star. You know, it's the star to the far right of those three. That is an O-class star that is clearly visible to us. B-class stars represent about 0.13%, you know, so about a seventh of 1% of all main sequence stars. So they're very rare, but they're much more common than O-class stars. And then you skip down to the A-class. They're more common still, about two-thirds of a percent of all main sequence stars. They're bluish-white, hot. And then the F-class stars, about 3% of main sequence. And you can kind of see the relative size of these different classifications. G, that's our sun, represents about 8% of all stars. And then the K stars, 13%. M-class stars, those are the red dwarfs, 78%. Betelgeuse is an example of a super red giant star. The circumference of that star would subsume the entire orbit of Jupiter, about 1 billion miles in diameter. Just think about that for a minute. Think of Jupiter, 500 million miles from the sun. Its orbit is about 1 billion miles in diameter. And that would define the circumference of the star Betelgeuse. Just think of it, a star that would extend to that degree. It's massive. Sirius B is an example of a white dwarf, about the size of the Earth with about half of the sun's mass, 170,000 times more dense than the sun. One teaspoon full of a white dwarf would be somewhere between 10 and 50 tons. Here's an example of a depiction of these stars that we just mentioned. Here is Betelgeuse. If you look at the three-star belt of Orion, you see Betelgeuse up there at the top. It's that red supergiant star. And then down here, you have Sirius B, which is a companion to Sirius, which is the brightest star in the sky, other than the sun. And then right here is Delta Orionis, which is a O-class star. So here we see Betelgeuse, the diameter of the star, compared to the size of the Earth's orbit or the size of Jupiter's orbit. You see how it's actually even larger than the orbit of Jupiter. Unbelievably huge. And it's clearly a reddish star in the sky if you look at the constellation Orion. Let's talk about the motion of stars for a few minutes. We see in these two photographic plates an example of proper motion, or the motion of a star across the sky. And if you look closely at those arrows, you can actually see how the star in these plates has moved slightly from the left plate to the right plate. This is Barnard's star over a 22-year span. Barnard Star is one of the three or four closest stars to our sun, and so it has a higher relative or proper motion compared to the more distant background stars that move much more slowly. The proper motion of Barnard Star would roughly approximate the size of a full moon over about a 180-year period of time. So over anybody's lifespan, you're basically not going to see any proper motion in the stars, even the closest ones. But over tens of thousands of years, or even hundreds of years, there will be a significant change in the pattern of the stars. The closer the star, the greater the proper motion. It would be like, you could liken this to watching traffic on a highway from 100 feet away versus from 5 miles away. Here are changes in the Big Dipper. The metal frame shows you the way it looks today. And it shows you the relative proper motion of the principal stars in that asterism. And the bottom slide shows you what the Big Dipper will look like 50,000 years from now. All of that can be easily calculated. Okay, let's talk about binary stars. Binary stars refer to stars that are typically double or triple or quadruple stars orbiting around a common center of gravity. The first known binary was Mizar, which actually is a quadruple star, four stars orbiting about a common center of mass in the Big Dipper handle. The Roman legions, by the way, were expected to split that star with the naked eye as an example of visual acuity. It was one of the basic tests in the training of Roman legionnaires. The very few people can do that today. Very few people. You look at the second star from the handle of the Big Dipper, that's Mizar, and try to split that into a double star. Here's Van Gogh's Starry Night. And believe me, you're not going to be able to do it. Here's a photograph of a few minutes, and you can see the duplicity there simply because of the length of that image. But try to look at that second star from the end of the handle of the Big Dipper. The Big Dipper is well situated right now, and see if you can split Mizar. Here's a software, planetarium software depiction of it, which really, I think, exaggerates it. I mean, I've never seen Mizar look like that before, where it's clearly a double star. But I'll tell you what, in just a couple of seconds of an image on a CCD camera, you will see the two stars there. And with binoculars, you can easily see it. Here's a photograph of the double star system there. Our star is not a double. Our star is not a binary. Our star is what's called a bachelor star. 70% of the stars in the universe are estimated to be binary or multiple stars. 50 to 75% of all stars. You might use the term multiple because binary refers to a double, and a lot of these stars are triple and quadruple and on up, 6, 7, 8 stars in the system. What is the impact of this on the question of extraterrestrial life? Well, you know, it is considered to be much more difficult for there to be a life-sustaining or habitable planet in a multiple star system than in a bachelor star system like ours for many reasons. It's not impossible, but the likelihood is considered to be much lower. And so when you take 60 to 70% of the stars in the universe are multiple stars, you know, you're pretty much writing off 70% of the stars in the universe as really prime candidates for life. We'll return to that topic in the last week. Now, there are different kinds of binary stars. Let's mention the three major types. The first are physical binaries. And a physical binary means they're actually gravitationally connected. They're orbiting about a common center of gravity. And they may be visual, meaning you can actually see it in a binoculars or a telescope. You can see the double star, and over the course of years, you can actually, by returning to and charting, mapping, or photographing that star, you can actually see the motion of those stars around their common center of gravity. Or spectroscopically, through a spectroscope, you can detect a star to be a physical double, even though you cannot see, you can't split them even with a telescope. And that's true for many binary stars. We just examine the spectrum that we obtain through a spectroscope to indirectly confirm that it's a double. And then you have a second major category of binary stars, which are what are called line-of-sight asterisms. They're just two stars that happen to look like they're a binary star system. And it's simply because of the line of sight. It's you have a very close, maybe 5 light-years away star right next to, in the sky, a star that may be 50 light-years away. Well, they're not gravitationally connected, but they look like they're a physical double, but in fact, they're a line-of-sight double. And how in the world do you know that? Well, you observe them over time to see if they're orbiting about a common center of gravity, and you take you measure them with data from the Hipparchus or some of these other satellites. Then you have eclipsing binaries. These can be visual or spectroscopic binaries whose orbital plane is oriented to our line of sight. I'll show you an example of that here in a minute. These are drawings of photographic plates, I guess, of, I don't remember which double star this is, but it was from 1908 to 1920. And you can clearly see how the double star here, you can estimate its period of rotation. So over this 12-year period of time, you know, it's gone about 25% of the way around the orbital. The orbit has completed about 25%. And that's how it's done. So you look at a star field like this. This is just a photo I snapped a few years ago of a open cluster M29. How many visual, spectroscopic, or line-of-sight binaries are there in there? I mean, it's just inconceivable when you're looking at a star field like this to actually be able to answer a question like that, other than through meticulous study of every potential binary in that field over the course of years. Here's an example of an eclipsing binary. Now keep in mind, binaries can be in all different configurations. They don't have to be on our line of sight. That's only about a 1 in 180 probability. Most of them are face-on, in which case we don't see any change in the light curve. But here we have an eclipsing binary where the smaller of the two stars goes in front of and behind the major star. And when that happens, we can see this yellow line here, which is the light curve, how it varies. So, for example, in position number 1, what do we have? We have the light curve way up here at maximum because we're seeing the light of both A and B. All right? One is not eclipsing the other. Now, when we go to position 2, the smaller star has moved behind the larger star. And so the overall light curve has dropped way down because we're only seeing the light of the A star, none from the B. And then you go to point number 3, we're back to the same place we were in point number 1, where the light of both stars is visible. Now the tricky one is when you go to point 4, where now all of a sudden the smaller star is on this side of the larger star. And as it turns out, because of the Stefan-Boltzmann law, star B is actually blocking a more luminous section from star A. So the overall luminosity declines slightly, and we're left here. So it's not a combination of A plus B. It's, it's rather B blocking out a portion of A, and the portion it's blocking out is a higher luminosity than what B would reflect because of that Stefan-Boltzmann law. So that's essentially how we look at light curves, and we can tell if a star is an eclipsing binary by just observing those curves, even if we can't see or split the two stars. Now, we've seen this a couple of times through the semester, that the mass of both of those stars in a binary system can be easily derived from Kepler's third law, as modified by Newton. The mass of both stars equals the radius or the distance between them cubed, divided by the period of orbit, their orbital period squared. and that would be in Earth years. So, for example, I think there's an example here of the mass of the Alpha Centauri system, which is a famous double star system. You just plug the numbers into the equation, and you can deduce or compute the combined mass of those stars, which is 2.1 solar masses. And so it's just absolutely amazing that you can measure the combined mass of a binary star system 25 trillion miles away when all you're doing is measuring how long the two of them take to rotate about each other and what their average distance or separation is based on that 400-year-old equation. Again, it's one of those powerful analytical tools in astronomy. Really, some would say the most powerful measuring device in astronomy. It's how we measure the masses of stars. Now, we've seen William Herschel before. He discovered the planet Uranus. He was actually the first person to measure gravitational orbit of a binary star system, the star Castor, which is right here in the constellation Gemini. Those are two stars that are almost identical in brightness, Castor and Pollux. And that's why they were given the name Gemini, the twins, by the ancient Greeks. So, again, he was the first person to detect gravitational orbits outside our solar system. He was able to determine that the star Castor was a double, and he actually measured the orbital period over the course of several years. Castor and Pollux, it turns out, are mentioned in Acts chapter 28. After 3 months, we put out to sea in a ship that had wintered in the island. It was an Alexandrian ship with the figurehead of the twin gods, Castor and Pollux. The start of the Mediterranean navigation system generally was assumed to be the rising of the constellation Gemini in the east, and so that would be when the stars Castor and Pollux began to rise. And so many Greek ships had those gods depicted on the bow of their ship, and so it was here recorded in the last chapter of the book of Acts. Okay, let's talk for a few minutes about variable stars. Do you see how that star is pulsating? It's getting brighter and then slowly dims again. Well, as it turns out, many stars in the sky are what are called variable stars. They're not constant burners like our sun that are steady. Rather, they are characterized by this pulsation, this period, this cycle of getting brighter and then getting dimmer. In most cases, these cycles are highly accurate and predictable. Here's another example of one. But it's an incredible story because variable stars were used and have been used as the principal measuring stick in the universe. Let's take a look at this incredible story. What was needed was a standard candle, something that was the same brightness everywhere in the universe. So if you have a 100 light bulb, you know it's a 100 watt light bulb, then from any distance, you can tell how far away it is simply by using the inverse square law. So what was needed was some type of standard candle to which we could apply the inverse square law and measure distances in space. Probably the first person to really study variable stars was a 19 and 20-year-old British astronomer named John Goodrick. He discovered Delta Cephei. He was he became deaf, I think, from a bout of scarlet fever. His parents were aristocratic family, and some evidence indicates they were just totally shocked and embarrassed by their disabled son, who developed a keen interest in astronomy at an early age. And in fact, he developed pneumonia from studying variable stars out late at night over and over again in the winter, and died when he was 20 years old of pneumonia. He did win a prize issued by the Royal Astronomical Society for his work on variable stars that was awarded just a week, I think, before his death. His family plot in the family estate, if you would go there today, you would see just a little stone that says J.G. And it's like the family couldn't even bring themselves to put their son's name on it. But be that as it may, he was deaf and mute, incidentally. He was able to do a lot of work with variable stars that became very important in the years to come. You see a light bulb in the distance. There's no way for you to know the intrinsic light or brightness of that bulb. You don't know what it is. But if you happen to know that it's a 100 light bulb, you can tell how far away it is from you at any distance by using the inverse square law. Luminosity decreases proportionally to the square of the distance. So what was needed was some standard candle, some 100 light bulb that is the same brightness anywhere in the universe that we could use to compute distances. The best candidate that we have thus far is the Cepheid variable star. Let's take a look here at at a field of stars without, here I've subtracted variable stars. Now this next image is going to show you this very same field where I've told the software to insert variable stars. So here it is without, here it is with. The bottom line is this, there's a lot of variable stars up there. A lot of amateurs are very actively involved in examining what's called the maxima and minima of variable stars. With certain equipment, you can measure to a high degree of accuracy the brightness of variable stars and track their period of time to see if there's any fluctuation or variation in it. Henrietta Leavitt was a clerk at the Harvard Observatory around the turn of the century, the 20th century. And it turns out that she stumbled onto a very significant discovery that was part of this story of finding a standard candle. She discovered 1,700 variable stars in the Large Magellanic Clouds, which is a very nearby galaxy to our own. The significance of this is all the stars in that cloud are the same distance away, essentially, from the sun. So what she did was examine 1,700 variables in the Large Magellanic Clouds, which included 20 Cepheids. So we can see here that Cepheid variable stars are very rare, fairly uncommon. And in 1912, she formulated what she called the period luminosity law. And the key point is that all Cepheids in the Large Magellanic Clouds are the same distance from the Earth, so their apparent magnitudes can be compared. And she discovers that the luminosity, the brightness of those Cepheid variables, is directly related to their period, how long it takes them to pulsate from minimum to maximum and then back down again. The longer the period of pulsation, the more luminous the star. She could easily see that because all the stars she was looking at were in the same group of stars. And so she discovered these 20 Cepheid variables, and the longer the period, and they range from about 3 days up to about 51 or so days, the longer the period of time that they pulsated, the brighter the star was. The shorter the period, the less luminous. Here's an example of one of the variables that she discovered on two different plates, minimum, maximum. Here is her period luminosity relation. Looking at luminosity on that axis versus the period in days down here. And you could we can ignore these, our Lyrae stars. These are the Cepheid variables right here. And here's this incredible correlation that she discovers, that the longer the period, up here to about 50, 55 days, that's about as long as they get, the more luminous they become. The shorter the period, you're down here, much less luminous. Luminosity and period are directly related. The most luminous Cepheids are the largest. Okay? The least luminous Cepheids are the smallest. But again, these are variable stars, these Cepheids, that average somewhere between 3 and 50 days. And that's how they're distinguished from others. Our Lyrae stars are stars with less, maybe, 0.3 to 1 here period in Earth days. So these are much shorter periods, and they're much less luminous, 100 versus 10,000, so you just can't see them, and certainly not in other galaxies. So they're not a good standard candle. Now, Leavitt could only correlate periods and apparent magnitudes, not the distance of the stars. But fortunately, the longer period Cepheids are so luminous, 10,000 times as luminous as our sun, that they are visible in distant galaxies tens of millions of light years away, which makes them a fantastic standard candle to use. Now, 1917, just 5 years after Leavitt makes her discovery, Harlow Shapley, born and raised in a dirt floor shack in southwest Missouri, not far from Edwin Hubble's birthplace. The two of them, the two greatest astronomers of the 20th century, both raised within 25 to 30 miles of where we're seated here tonight. Shapley, he takes the data from Leavitt, but he also was able to take several Cepheid variables whose distances had been measured by parallax in recent years, and with that data, he's able to compute their absolute magnitude, that is, their brightness, if that star were put at a distance of 10 parsecs away, and then using the inverse square law. And then he's able to correlate period, in this chart right here, the period of these Cepheids with their absolute magnitude. So again, he's able to take Leavitt's data from this first chart, and because he knew the actual distances of several Cepheids that had been measured by triangulation, he's able to determine what their absolute magnitudes were as well. And with that data, he can correlate the period of Cepheid variables with not just how bright they appear, but how bright they actually are. And with this, he comes up with what was called the distance modulus table or equation. And that is a tool that we use today to measure the distance of galaxies in space by looking at the absolute magnitude and apparent magnitude based on this chart right here. The key point, if the apparent and absolute magnitudes are known, the distance can be computed. We don't need to get into the details of that. It's a fairly complex process reduced to an equation today. But the bottom line for us to remember is that Shapley takes the data from Leavitt along with parallax measurements of the actual distance to certain Cepheid variables. And with that data, he's able to come up with a formula for computing the distance of Cepheid variable stars based on their periods. And with this information, for the first time, the limiting chains of parallax were broken, and distances to the galaxies could be computed directly. Remember, parallax can only measure objects to about 300 light years away. But with Cepheid variable stars, we can measure galaxies out to 60 to 100 million light years. Again, because those long period Cepheids are extremely luminous, 10,000 times brighter than our sun. They have become literally the universe's yardstick. Now, in 1917, the largest telescope in the world was completed at Mount Wilson, the Hooker telescope, 100-inch telescope. Here's a picture of it. It was the largest telescope in the world for about 30 years, up until the Palomar telescope was built in Southern California. In 1923, Edwin Hubble detects Cepheid variable stars in M31, which is the Andromeda Galaxy, about 2.2 million light years away. Here's a photographic plate with Hubble's own handwriting right here. It says VAR! Exclamation mark. In other words, he's saying there, I found a Cepheid variable. He knew the significance of that. You find a Cepheid variable in this cloud, which at that point we still didn't know what it was, a galaxy or a cloud of stars within our own Milky Way galaxy. He's able to calculate the distance to that galaxy. He was slightly off, but it was close enough that he realized that he was looking at an object that was a huge distance away. It was the first proof that these nebulae, these spiral nebulae as they were called, which showed up in all kinds of photographic plates of the universe, these little smudges of light, what were they? Were they separate islands of stars, separate galaxies outside of our own? Or were they just little clouds of gas within our own Milky Way galaxy? That was a debate that that raged throughout the 19th and into the mid into the early 20th centuries until Hubble's discovery. And that's why it's often said that Hubble literally discovered the universe. Resolution of individual stars in M31, that's the Andromeda Galaxy in 1926 with that Hooker telescope, confirmed this hypothesis to be the case. And today, the distance of numerous galaxies have been computed using Cepheid variable stars. The Hubble Space Telescope has detected many more Cepheids and computed distances to several remote galaxies. Here's an example of one, which is the galaxy M100. And these are actual Hubble Space Telescope images of a Cepheid variable. With this data, using Shapley's distance modulus calculation, we can compute, and this is this area right here, which is in the remote regions of this galaxy. But over the course of, I don't remember how many days this was, you can see the Cepheid variable. And with that data, NASA astronomers were able to estimate that galaxy is 51 million light years away. Here's another example of pictures taken in that galaxy, M100. And here it shows the dates over a period of a little over a month. And that was calculated, as I recall, about a 51-day cycle. And knowing the apparent magnitude, using that distance modulus table of Harlow Shapley, the actual distance to that galaxy could be computed with relative confidence at 51 million light years away. Now, there are just a few other items here in the chapter, and then we'll probably get out a few minutes early tonight. But I want to talk about star clusters. And there are basically two major types of star cluster. This is an example of an open star cluster, sometimes called a galactic star cluster. These are just stars that are very loosely associated. They're gravitationally associated, but they're not a compact group of stars. They're more diffuse, they're more spread out. And this is actually a very famous double cluster in the constellation Perseus. This is one open cluster here and a second one over here, one of the most frequently photographed objects in the heavens by amateurs. This is an example of a globular star cluster, which is like a giant snowball where the stars are just packed in very densely. In fact, if you look at an open cluster like these two, you're looking at stars in the dozens to maybe few hundreds, total population. Whereas in a globular star cluster, the snowball type, these can be up to a million or more stars in that cluster. These are magnificent objects. An object here, this is M80, I believe. It's got several hundred thousand stars in it. And yet, if you took a rifle and shot it right through the heart of that cluster, your chance of hitting a star would be about 1 in 100 billion. And that is because, as dense as it looks, you're still talking about basketballs separated by thousands of miles. The stellar density, here's a picture I took of M3. The stellar density there in the middle is about 100 stars per cubic light year. There's a picture I took of a globular cluster, NGC 2417, or 2419, I never remember. But this is called the Intergalactic Wanderer. This is actually one of the most remote globular clusters. I think there's been 150 globular clusters that have been detected in the Milky Way galaxy. They're all surrounding the nucleus of our galaxy in what's called a coma. So there's just this huge sphere of globular clusters surrounding the core of our galaxy. Now, if you take your Hertzsprung-Russell diagram for an older open cluster, it's interesting. You'll notice there's no more heavy main sequence stars. these stars that would be up here. There, you don't see any red dots going all the way from about halfway up the main sequence to the upper left-hand corner. They're all gone. Those are your O, your B, your A, your F stars. They burned up. They're not there anymore. And so for an old cluster, you're not going to see any stars in that region of the HR diagram. You have some red giants forming up here. Probably a few white dwarfs. Now here's an HR diagram for a very old cluster, estimated to be 5 billion years old. And again, you just keep coming down the main sequence. You don't see any stars in this galaxy, in this cluster. You don't see any stars that are O, B, A, or F stars. Why not? Because they're not on the main sequence anymore. They've burned up and they've left. Heavier stars have moved to the red giant stage. So here's an example of those two. This is a younger cluster, and we can just use this green line here to calibrate these two charts. But you see a lots of stars above the green line here, none over here basically, except for a few red giants, because at least none on the main sequence. And that is because this is the current model anyway, that this cluster is much younger. And so you're going to have stars, some of those heavier stars, maybe the A and the F stars, that have not yet burned up their fuel and moved off the main sequence. So the older the cluster of stars gets, the shorter this wick becomes. And you can calculate and estimate the age of star clusters by looking at this HR diagram.